Hi, everyone. My name is Maya, and welcome to Psych Mike, the podcast that explores the lives and career paths of industry leaders who use psychology to make an impact in the world. This week, we're mixing it up a bit. Instead of interviewing a guest about their life and career path, I wanted to devote an entire episode, actually two episodes, to answering your questions about applying to graduate school in clinical psychology, because this is the category where I tend to get the most questions. Now, if you're new to Psych Mike, we don't only cover careers in clinical areas, so if you're wanting to explore other options, those definitely exist on the podcast. You can also go to psychmike.com and search for episodes by category. So today's episode will be part one of a two-part series about becoming a more competitive applicant to doctoral programs in clinical psychology. Part one today will focus mainly on the preparing side of things. So topics that relate to anything about gaining the necessary experience before it actually comes time to apply. Part two, which will be released next week, will focus mainly on the applying itself. So I do not have nearly enough expertise to answer all the questions that I receive from you guys about the grad school application process myself. So I decided to interview two people whom I trust very, very much to give you top-notch information about the admissions process. First, we have Daisy Ort, whom some of you may remember if you came to Psych Mike's graduate school panel in November. Daisy is a fourth-year PhD candidate in clinical psychology at Teachers College, Columbia University. And besides obviously having gone through the process of applying to grad school herself, this girl has helped countless students through every stage of the process to help them bolster their applications to clinical programs. She understands this process inside out, and I really, really trust her. If by the end of this you want more advice from Daisy and other students in clinical areas, I've linked the recording from our graduate school panel in November in the show notes. Along with Daisy, we have her doctoral advisor, Dr. Barry Farber. Dr. Farber has been on admissions committees for over 40 years, so he reviews hundreds of applications every single year, and he really understands what makes for a successful application. He was also the director of clinical training for 25 years at Teachers College. So in this episode, we will first do a general overview of the different kinds of ways that you can get licensed as a clinician. So PhD versus PsyD versus MSW, MFT, and other master's routes. We talk about the difference between clinical psychology and counseling psychology, and the differences in career outlooks between master's level and doctoral level clinicians. Then we get into the actual preparation, so timeline, when you should start getting experiences, what is important to focus on while you're still in college, when you should take a gap year, when a master's degree is helpful before you apply for doctoral programs. We talk about publishing papers, whether that's important, how to stand out in your applications. I don't want to get too much into it. If you're curious about the specific topics, you can go into the show notes and look at everything we cover with the timestamps. So in this episode, we'll focus mainly on PhD programs, but we'll also talk about elements that differ between PhD and PsyD applications at various points. So next week, we'll be talking more in detail about the actual application process. So once you've done all the prep work in terms of gaining all of that experience, what do you do when it's actually time to apply? How do you compile your list of programs? What are important things to consider? How do you write a personal statement that stands out? How do you update your CV? What should you be paying attention to when it comes to the GRE? Is that important? We talk about letters of recommendation and grades and all sorts of things like that when it comes to the application process. So if you're left with more questions after today, fear not. Next week, we'll have a whole new episode also about this. So let's just get right into this. I'm very excited to present this to you. I think there's so much valuable information here. I actually encourage you to take out a pen and a piece of paper or take notes on your phone and just go soak it all in. So here we go. Welcome, Daisy. Welcome, Dr. Farber. It's nice to have you both here to be doing a very special episode of Psych Mike. It is a style that I have not done before yet on this podcast, but highly requested and highly anticipated now by my audience. So thank you for being here.
Sure.
So before we get into the meat and potatoes of applying to graduate school, preparing for graduate school, all that fun stuff, I want you to introduce yourself. So if you could just say what your general research areas are and what your experience with graduate school admissions has been, so that we know what in what capacity you've been involved in, the, in these processes. So Daisy, let's start with you.
Okay. Well, I'm Daisy. I'm a fourth year PhD student at Teachers College, Columbia University. Dr. Farber, who's with us today, is my advisor. My experience with applications is having been an applicant a couple of years ago, and also having the opportunity to work with a lot of the master students in our program as they apply to doctoral programs. And also, yeah, some help with reviewing some applications over time. And what was it you asked about the my research interest?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, Dr. Farber could speak to that too, because I'm interested in a lot of what he does. But right now, our lab is focusing on positive regard and teletherapy as part of a broader psychotherapy research lab.
Nice. And Daisy, what are your just broadly clinical experiences that you're involved in right now?
So I'm an extern at Bellevue in an inpatient unit and at a substance abuse residential treatment program at the VA.
Amazing. We can get into that a little bit more if it becomes relevant a little bit later. But Dr. Farber, how about you?
How about me? I've been at Teachers College, Columbia University. This is my 43rd year. That's remarkable.
Yes, that is remarkable.
I really believe it. My first and only academic job. And for many of those years, I was actually director of clinical training for almost 25 of those years, though thankfully no longer. Research interests. Let's see. As Daisy said, we have one lab that she has so remarkably well run for the last few years on Carl Rogers' notion of positive regard and how both patients and therapists see positive regard being implemented in psychotherapy. And another piece that labs have been working on is the whole notion of self-disclosure, what patients do and don't disclose to therapists, what therapists do and don't disclose to their patients, the extent to which people are, in fact, telling the truth when they disclose or sometimes dissembling. So those are some of the pieces. And what Daisy did not say, we should make a plug for this, is that we have a book coming out on positive regard in a few months from APA.
Wow. I didn't know that either, Daisy.
Yep.
Thanks for telling me.
Maybe we could offer a discount to your listeners.
Here we go. Understanding and Enhancing Positive Regard, Carl Rogers and Beyond.
Wow. And I can't wait to get my hands on that. That's when will that be out?
Around September 1.
Wow. Okay. Well, let me know when that, Daisy, you'll let me know and I'll include the link in the show notes so that you guys can check it out. And maybe we can do a little affiliate discount for PsychMic listeners. So thank you for that introduction. Just to kind of give everybody an overview of what we'll be talking about today, I collected questions through the PsychMic newsletter and through the Instagram and just asking around to see what you guys want to know about the graduate school application process. And today we're talking specifically about clinical programs, particularly clinical doctoral programs. I received close to 50 questions, so we will get through as much as we can. I can't promise we'll get to all of the questions that you guys sent in, but we'll do our best. Before we get into that, I want to give a general overview of the different types of programs, graduate programs that you can go to in order to get licensed as a clinician. You don't have to go to a doctoral program in order to do that. So overall, I'd like to ask you both, what are the major differences between a PhD, a PsyD, an MSW, and master's programs? So master's in counseling programs, and maybe also if you want to talk about MFT programs, but So just general overview.
Yeah, Daisy, you start. If I have anything to add, I will.
I was going to recommend that you start.
Fine, I'll start. All right. Let's talk about the one that's the most difficult to get into, and too many people think it's the only pathway to take. It's the PhD program in clinical psychology. It's the most difficult to get into because there are more applicants. The proportion of applicants to slots is dramatic. For example, at Teachers College this year, we had nearly 600 applicants, and we took in, I think, 7 new students. So we can start with that. And there's probably 150 or so PhD programs across the country. I suppose we can get into this a little bit later. But in general, the ones that are most difficult to get into are the ones that are in the most geographically usually preferred cities, you know, New York, Boston, Los Angeles, San Francisco, et cetera. Though there are many other very prestigious, terrific PhD programs, those aren't the only ones. Then we have PsyD programs, which have proliferated and become more than acceptable. Some of them are quite excellent, that don't suppose that you have any particular interest in learning to do research or becoming involved in some research lab. That takes away the likelihood that you're going to have to exaggerate in your PhD applications the extent to which you actually want to do research. So if you truly want to become a therapist and you're only marginally interested at best in learning to do research, PsyD programs are a terrific alternative. Differences, of course, is that they focus almost exclusively on clinical work. Sometimes they're a year so less in length. That is, you can usually finish a PsyD in 4 years, sometimes five, as opposed to 5 or 6 or more in clinical PhD programs. They tend not to provide any or sometimes only minimal financial aid. So that's a dramatic difference too. Although again, because there are fewer years in length, it may cost you somewhat less. Actually, it's going to cost you somewhat more, but per year at, that you're going to be a student 1 year less means that you can be employed a year earlier. MS programs, another terrific opportunity for those who are serious about wanting to become psychotherapists, but are not terribly interested or for whatever reason of being involved in a program for 5 or 6 years. You can get a perfectly acceptable and excellent education in an MSW program in 2 years. And either become employed as a therapist in either, private practice or more likely in some sort of clinic situation or become involved in policy. Traditionally, historically, MSWs have learned a lot about social policy. Mm-hmm. MFTs, among others, marriage and family therapy. They're master's degree programs. And again, if you're particularly interested in doing couples work, families work, you can get a degree in about 2 years as well. And obviously you're specializing in doing that kind of work, but all of these are license eligible and all of these are usually third party reimbursable. Well, there's another piece. Oh, maybe we should talk for a moment too, because some people are wondering about PhD programs in clinical versus PhD programs in counseling.
Yep. I was going to ask that.
Well, you know, when a former colleague of mine used to be asked that question, who's now retired from Teachers College, what's the difference between a PhD program in clinical and counseling? He used to sort of give the snarky answer. He used to say, when you graduate, the answer is about $10 an hour, meaning that the PhD program in clinical is somewhat more prestigious. At least it has been historically. It's been historically more difficult to get into. Historically, PhD programs in clinical have tended to focus more on psychopathology per se, the DSM, et cetera. Whereas counseling programs have tended to focus on things like health, vocational rehab, et cetera. But in the last few years, the differences have become more minimal, with one interesting new difference is that counseling programs, there are some reasons, but it's a little bit irrelevant to what we're talking about now, have become far more focused on issues of cultural diversity. And clinical has somehow been, you know, belatedly joined this important venture. Mm. So people who are very interested in issues of diversity, inclusion, multicultural counseling have usually found better homes in counseling psychology than clinical psychology. Mm. That's the quick overview.
Thank you. Daisy, would you add anything?
First of all, feeling very affirmed that I said Dr. Farber should start with
this. That was a great overview.
Yeah. Oh, you covered a lot of ground. A quick a quick few points on some of the things you mentioned. So the MSW piece, if you're somebody who is struggling with doing well in the GRE, and we could talk about whether or not things are going to change with programs maybe waiving that requirement. But given the landscape right now, if you're someone that's tried multiple times to take the GRE and it's just, you're not cracking it, which is fine. There's many different ways to excel. Thinking about an MSW is, I think, a really, really good idea. My current therapist right now is an LCSW and is one of the best therapists I've ever met. And I meet a lot of doctoral therapists. So I think that it's really a great option. I will add that some people are under the conception that the program is 2 years and then you're just working full time. And mm-hmm. you do have 3 years between an MSW and when you become an LCSW, where you are getting supervised clinical hours. So just keeping in mind that it's not 2 years and you're done. It is still a 5-year process till you're really practicing as an independent clinician.
Yeah.
That's one point. And then the other point, and maybe we'll talk about this more when we talk about how people can structure the list of schools that they apply to and all the things to consider. But one thing when thinking about what's right for you in terms of a PsyD or a PhD, clinical or counseling, is really realizing how individualistic this entire process is. And so the things you might be used to, like what are the top universities in the country, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Columbia, what, you know, UCLA, whatever you want, is very different here. And Dr. Barber alluded to this with the clinical and counseling piece, is like, you're really going to want to look at each program. There are PsyD programs that are extremely competitive, more competitive than some PhD programs. There are counseling doctoral programs that are more competitive than some clinical, and vice versa. And so as you think about what degree is right for you and you think about what school is right for you, just remember how there's not like a formula or like a random ranking list of what would be best.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. We'll talk about that prestige point is something I wanted to bring up a little bit later when we talk about how to come up with your list of schools. As for like the individual process, I want to just say that we've given a general overview, but there's so much nuance that we haven't covered about the difference between these programs. Where would you two recommend that people go read up more about the differences between these programs and whether the, and assess which one they would be right for?
There is the book.
Is this Michael Syatt and John Norcross's book?
That's okay. The book.
Insider's Guide to Applying to Graduate School in Clinical Psychology. I was wondering when that book would be brought up. It's pretty soon into the interview, which I'm glad about. So I'll make sure to link that in the description. That book is excellent.
And what that book does for PhD and PsyD programs is essentially provide a concentrated list of all the information that's important. So for people that are thinking about an MSW or whether or not they want to do this, generally looking at any school that you might be interested in, you want to consider the faculty, the areas of specialization and interest, the cost of the tuition, obviously if you have geographic limitations, and the length of time that most people complete, and then also what graduates end up doing. So whether it's an internship match rate for doctoral programs or fellowships or internships for social work programs, like those are all good barometers for figuring out where you might want to go. And what the Insider's Guide does is actually go through all the PsyD and PhD programs in the country and tell you what are the GRE scores of the people that apply, what are their match rates, et cetera. And so if you're not thinking of a doctoral program, you could still kind of learn from that book what information you should be honing in on when you look
totally.
At
it. Totally. Amazing. I did get a question about the career outlook differences between doctoral level clinicians and master's level clinicians. If you guys want to touch on that very briefly before we jump into the rest of it, I think that's a helpful question.
I'm going to leave this to Dr. Farber too. I'll add if there's anything to add.
Well, the easiest, most focused answer is that with a doctorate, obviously you have more opportunities, particularly teaching opportunities, right? You have more research opportunities. If you really love the idea of teaching, you know, an undergraduate or graduate level, the PhD is usually required, or PsyD, but that's one of the disadvantages of having a license eligible master's degree program. It limits your opportunities to teach. I'm not sure what else.
How about salary?
Well, it's an interesting question. Because obviously, if you're in private practice, you set your own salary, right? I mean, there are probably master's degree people, experienced master's degree people who were charging, you know, per session as much as PhD people. It's whatever the market can bear. And especially in this market, you know, there's actually a shortage of therapists. So I suspect that, you know, many people have just allowed themselves to set prices at whatever level. Yeah, I mean, sure. And if you're going to be employed in a hospital setting, in some ways, like here in New York at Psychiatric Institute, you're going to get paid a lot more money with a PhD degree than a master's level degree. And your opportunities for where you're placed on the team is going to be quite different. So yeah, there are differences in opportunities and pay, but you know, I think people shouldn't forget if your primary focus, as a lot of people's focus really is, on being a therapist, mm-hmm. one shouldn't preclude the possibility of getting a master's degree if the PhD degree, for whatever reason, just competitiveness or you're not a good test taker, doesn't allow you to pursue that dream. But there's other ways of pursuing your dream, and people shouldn't forget that.
Yeah. Daisy, do you want to add something about licensure? Red tape?
Well, in terms of master, well, 2 points on this general overall question. And I mean, I'm a doctoral student, so I haven't really seen the job market yet. But I think the two things to also really think about, one is versatility and how important that is to you. And so if you foresee potentially wanting a variety of different options, as your career, and you want to leave doors open, so you might want to be a professor and seriously considering that, or you might want to work as a chief psychologist in a hospital, or you might want to have a private practice, or you might want to end up going into business and do analytics for how to capitalize on human talent, right? Like, there's a lot of different things you could do with a doctoral degree. Specifically, a PhD is the most versatile. And a PsyD is really versatile within the field of clinical psychology. It's more and more common for PsyDs who do want to publish a lot, they could to be professors and be accepting students, et cetera. But, and the same with social work. There's a lot of versatility there in terms of, like, and Dr. Barber is mentioning this, in terms of going into policy or working in a variety of different settings. And so versatility is important to somebody, keeping in mind what degree is versatile. A master's degree, a master's level licensed clinician, is very not versatile, and that you will be a therapist in the state where you get licensed. And I don't know if there's updated new ways for anyone to transfer that degree. I know when I was looking into these options 5, 6, 7 years ago, you couldn't. You only can work in the state that you were licensed, and you can't move. And so I'm a big leave all of my options open kind of person. And that was, you know, beneficial for me. But for someone that knows, I want to be a therapist, I want to sit across from another human being, patient after patient, individual therapy, maybe keeping your options open is not that important. And then mm-hmm. you might want to choose something that's quicker and more specialized specific.
Yeah. Okay. This is great. So let's now move on to the preparing piece of this conversation. So I think first it would be helpful to talk about the timeline. The first question is, when should you start working on becoming competitive? So how long before you plan to apply should you be acquiring all these necessary experiences?
6th grade. Daisy, you start with this one.
I definitely didn't start in 6th grade, Barry. Now you know. I think there's 2 answers to that question. One is, if you know that you want to be a psychologist, or you're very interested in psychology in undergrad, there is definitely many, many things you can do in undergrad to start being competitive. 2 is, I just want to make it clear, if you have no idea and you graduated in something different and you do want to do this, there's no too late. Do you want to put in the time? So that's, like, broad overview kind of response. So when it comes to people who are in undergrad and know that they're majoring in psychology and that they're really interested in one day, let's say applying to a doctoral program in clinical or counseling psychology, I would say getting research experience while you're in undergrad, when you have access to professors who are doing research and research labs, is a great idea. Getting some clinical experience to let you know if you do want to do this, because I don't understand how someone could really know that they want to do this without any clinical experience whatsoever, or it's possible to have an idea, but to be sure. And so doing clinical assistantship or clinical positions, volunteering, whether it's at a suicide hotline or a rape crisis hotline, or there are a lot of things that undergrads could get involved in, intake specialists, et cetera. So I think starting in your sophomore year, starting in your junior, they're all beneficial. If you graduate and you didn't do any of these things, there's still a lot of things that you could do
right
post undergrad, and you should.
Yeah. I think the subtext of this question is, how many years of like solid experience do you need to have on your CV to be competitive? So whether that's research experience, clinical experience, you know, I guess that's the question is, if I graduate from undergrad and I look back and I'm like, oh shoot, you know, I maybe only have 6 months of significant research experience, how many more years do I need to get that stuff under my belt?
I mean, I would say there is a lot of individual differences there. Is somebody GRE score really high? Do they have strong letters of recommendation from 2 out of 3 of them already done from professors? How much experience do they have in undergrad, et cetera? If you want to tell me, let's just say a career change and they got a great GPA and they studied journalism in undergrad and they didn't think they'd want to do psychology, and now they realize that they do, and they finish the GRE easily and they have a good GPA and they have a good letter of recommendation, and now they have nothing in psychology, I would say probably 2 years from when they start until their application is very competitive. Okay. Dr. Barber, what do you think?
I think it's reasonable. I think it's complicated too. As you said, it depends on particular faculty. Remember that many schools have moved toward a mentor model of application, where you're as much applying to work with a particular faculty member as you are applying to a particular school. So different faculty members have very different senses of just how much research experience a candidate has, and relatedly, how much research experience and interest a candidate has in his or her particular brand of research. So some faculty members are saying, it doesn't matter, you know, that you haven't had research in my particular area, but you've done research and you understand how research works. And if you say you're interested in doing what I'm doing, it won't be hard to train you, you know, to do the specific things that our lab is doing. Other faculty members are very insistent that if you're applying to work with me, you have to not just say that you're interested, but sort of prove it. With whom have you worked with? What have you read? Have you been on any posters, articles, conference presentations where you've, you know, actually, you know, had a track record of showing that what you say you're interested in, you've actually done. So there's tremendous variety in faculty's sense of what what the minimum requirements are, but you need something. I mean, at least for the PhD program, if that's what we're talking about, it's you're simply not going to get in if you don't have research experience. Remember, technically a PhD degree is a research degree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So within that question, within that, what you were just talking about how it really differs between mentors, how are you supposed to figure out where your potential mentor lies on that spectrum? How do you go about assessing that before you actually apply?
The book helps. The book will tell you, this Sayette and Norcross book will tell you, I don't remember whether it goes per faculty member. I think it actually lists just the kinds of research that programs are doing. Is that right? I think so, right? Yeah. Well, then you do your, if I'm right on that, then you do your homework. You go to the websites. You know, if you see in the book, you know, that the program is offering this and this and this, you go to the website of the program and see which faculty member is actually doing the work that the program is supposedly doing. Or you just do your basic Google research. I'm interested in whatever, and working with borderline patients. So, you know, I'm Googling treatment of borderline patients, and I'm seeing what comes up recently, and I'm looking at who's published the most recent or the most interesting to me articles. And then knowing who's done that, I go to their particular website and see exactly what they've done and whether they're taking students. What would you add to that, Daisy?
Just, and very broadly, because as we hone in on like the specifics, again, just taking a step back, is that there's no exceptions to like everyone has, if we're talking about doctoral programs in clinical psychology, you're going to have a couple of buckets, the GRE bucket, the GPA bucket, the research experience bucket, the clinical experience bucket, the letter of recommendation bucket, and how well is this program or mentor a good fit for you kind of bucket. Now, of course, there are exceptions to some rules, but none of these buckets could be empty, really, kind of a terrible GPA. Or maybe if you do, then you have a master's, but you can't have a horrible, or none of them could be completely empty. I mean, there will be 100% weaknesses and strengths in that yes. overview. But when you, there are definitely differences in advisors in terms of preferences and what advisor would prioritize, let's say identical research match versus person's clinical skills will vary. But if you're attending to all those buckets in some way and you have a good spread of programs, generally should be okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's helpful. That step back is really helpful. Now going back to timeline, Daisy, when would you say people should take the GRE? Like how many months before, how many years before you actually apply?
I generally like the pay now, play later approach or pay now while you're playing approach. But I think something like the GRE that is a major currently as it exists, and I'm not saying it should be this way or I like it, but that something that right now is a major indicator to what kind of programs you will be competitive to. If you're getting a 40th, 50th percentile on the GRE and you're applying to programs where their average is like 70th percentile, you want it, you're banking on being an extreme, extreme exception to the rule. And so I don't see how people should take the GRE as early as possible before deciding what programs and mentors they want to apply to, because that will tell them whether or not, or at least that was my approach. Sometimes I look back and think I could have applied before really crushing the GRE. And maybe that was a little like I was too focused on that. But generally, I think people should try to take the GRE to give them a sense of what programs they could apply to. They could apply to some programs where the average is a little below their score. They could, and some programs where the average is a little below, higher than their score, but how many degrees of freedom away? You know, like what do you, yeah.
I think I saw somewhere that you should pay less attention to like what your percentile rank is, but more like what's the interquartile sort of range. Like, don't worry about your particular number, but rather make sure you're falling in a range of where they typically accept students.
Yeah. And to that point, that don't confuse that national averages as average for doctoral right. programs. But in this book that we're talking about, every program will have an average GRE, the GRE averages for the incoming student. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to be very, very far from that, from all the programs you apply to. And a lot of people think that the GRE doesn't matter because it's not about psychology, but it does. Maybe just because there's too many applications.
Well, I'm
in that regard, people think that because they have a high GPA, they're going to be great candidates. Unfortunately, that's no longer true because of grade inflation. Almost everyone applies with over a 3.6, and there are a lot of people who apply with 3.9s or 4.0s. You know, it's like Harvard saying, if we wanted to fill our whole class, we could with valedictorians only. The competition is great, and sometimes the only common metric are GRE scores. That said, the opposite trend is that more and more programs are doing away with GRE scores.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna hold the GRE conversation. I promise I'll come back to it. I'm sure people have a million questions about it. I promise I'll come back. But I want to get into some other questions that we have here about preparing. What a question that I got from, I think, an earlier undergrad is, what are some early steps that you can take in your college career to become a competitive graduate school applicant? And I know in general, we talk about clinical experience and research experience. But you know, in general, what should people be focusing on to become competitive while they're still in college?
Take stat courses, even if you think you're not going to like them or do well in them. because as programs become more research oriented, and most have, faculty are going to look for people who know how to do stats, especially I'm thinking of myself right now, which I was once reasonably good at stats. As I've gotten older, I've lost track of, you know, more sophisticated stats, and I rely more and more on my grad students to do stats for me. So I'm looking for people who are comfortable and know how to do stats. The other thing is learn how to write grants. And the third thing is learn how to write. You're going to be writing a lot. And if you don't think your writing is up to par, on, you know, enroll in writing workshops, get help with your writing. So yeah, other than getting, and it's hard to get clinical experiences in undergrad. I mean, you can, you know, learn how to, you can volunteer for some organizations, but yeah, other than volunteering for some clinical work and research work, learn how to do grants, learn how to be comfortable with stats, and make sure that your writing is excellent.
On the grants piece, how do you do that? How do you get involved in grants? Is this just something you need to talk to your PI about on your research team? Like, yeah. Hey, I want to get involved in grants because I'm looking to apply to graduate school in the future.
Yeah, or go on sites like APA or Society for Psychotherapy Research. And there's often webinars about writing grants, or even going to conferences of APA or SPR, multiple other organizations. Almost always, you know, there are pre-conference workshops on writing grants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Daisy, would you add?
So the only thing I'll add, and Maya kind of learned this or relearned this from talking to you the past couple of months, is be conscientious, but don't be shy. Like, is in your undergraduate program, if you actually are really interested in psychology and do have psychology professors available, or you are in a lab, offer, go above and beyond. No matter how many people are in the lab, there's somebody that should know the person you're reporting to or the person they're reporting to, and try and take on more. I know that when I have RAs who ask for more, I really do turn to them when I need help, and it does end up creating more opportunities. And so if you're going to turn to professors and ask them for a letter of recommendation, like, it would be great if you took more than one class with them. And if you also asked them questions and were really engaged and paid attention, and I don't know where you could speak to this, but you know the difference between a student who, or an RA, right, who really goes the extra miles, really engaged, really interested, really make sure to like put in the work. It stands out, right? Like amongst a larger group of people. So,
Yeah, I think that's something that people regret later on, that not doing. Like, you know, they'll finish undergrad and they'll be like, it's time to ask for a letter of recommendation. And they're like, wait, I wish I had put in a little bit more so that this person could speak a little bit more to my abilities in, or at least become a better advocate for me. We'll talk about letters of recommendation when it comes to applying. But so these are steps in your early college career. And then we'll talk now about clinical versus research experience, and really get into that, because this is a huge, area of questions that I always get. So the first question I have is, how important is getting clinical experience versus getting research experience, and which one should you emphasize or focus on as you're preparing to become competitive?
Well, if for a PhD program, you're going to need both. There may be minor exceptions, but you're not getting into a PhD program unless you have both clinical and research experience. If you're applying to a PsyD, then the research experience becomes far less important.
Does the preference for balance between clinical, actually, we already talked about this, the different faculty advisors will emphasize clinical or research experience in different ways.
Yeah, but that's a yes, but everyone's going to want both. It's only a question of degree. So even within our program, there are faculty members who are so focused on research, they want their students to have clinical experience, but they're not emphasizing that. Then there are people who are, you know, so a lot of people are more middle ground. You know, I want the best applicants, or the ones I'm considering most highly, to know how to do research, and at least to have had enough clinical experience for them to have gotten feedback that this is a good match for them.
Mm. Did you want to add, Daisy?
Yeah. So, you know, kind of linking this to the previous question. And so especially when it comes down to undergrad, I want to say, like, clinical experience, everyone is aware, especially faculty advisors who are often have a PhD, that you're not going to be a therapist before starting your program. And so clinical experience does not need to be the highest level, closest you could get to doing clinical work, like working for a practice where you're doing the intake or you're giving the screeners or you're giving the assessment. The better the clinical experience, of course, that's a cherry on top. But any sort of interaction that you could have with people who are experiencing distress, and your letter of recommendation could speak to that you have an interpersonal skill of relating to people, that you improve their experience, whatever it is, it's going to help. And so not to throw out the baby with the bathwater of, like, wow, that's such a terrible expression. I wonder where it came from.
I'll tell you later.
With the barrel.
From the Middle Ages, where people actually didn't have baths, but once a month or so, and they were actually worried in communal baths that the baby wasn't going to come out.
Oh my gosh.
Right. Okay. This is to make sure our listeners are still awake. but really thinking creatively. So, like, it could be, I wouldn't say, like, being a day camp counselor is, like, a great clinical experience, but showing, if you're applying to work with to a doctor program, or you're applying to a mentor who works with kids, and you want to have an indication, you want to show them that you actually work well with kids, then that would be relevant. So not to get super, like, kind of pretentious about how good does this clinical thing sound, but could you show that you have these skills? Mm-hmm. And I had one other thought that will come back to me.
Let me go back to something, because I think maybe we're assuming, and should be more explicit, that very few programs are going to take people straight from their undergraduate years. You know, so we're talking about, you know, getting, doing this and this as undergrads. And yeah, you more think about it, you know, it's going to be hard to learn how to write a grant as an undergrad, not impossible. But many programs, you know, prefer people with at least a couple of years of post BA experience. And a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is probably far more likely to happen, you know, after you graduated with your BA, getting involved in research at some, you know, local hospital, or you know, or volunteering, you know, in some program, graduate program near you before you even apply. So let's make that explicit. A lot of the experience is going to happen, not as an undergrad, but you can begin it, but a lot of it in the 2 years, 3 years after you graduate.
Totally. And I think that's actually comforting. I think that's comforting, because I think a lot of students think they have to, like, pack all of this into undergrad, when most of us aren't even thinking about this until at the very end, and sometimes even not, you know. So it's helpful to know that actually it's good to have that programs value a few years of extra experience afterwards. Daisy,
what people don't realize also is the day you start a doctoral program, 3 months later, you're interacting with patients often in some capacity, whether it's intake or therapy or assessment. And so programs are looking for people who have some lived experience, because coming straight out of undergrad and then being a therapist the next day is not impossible. It's just extremely rare, because I started the program when I was 27 or 28, and I thought I was going to be, like, the oldest, and I'm the median. Like, there are two, you know, so it's like, actually I'm one of the younger. So it's like, it's not a bad thing to take your time mm-hmm. and get some experience.
Mm-hmm. So now getting into, like, we'll go specifically into research experiences now. Someone asked if there's any specific experiences within the broad spectrum of research experience that's more valuable than other research experiences. So, for example, will working as a CRC, a clinical research coordinator, be more valuable or as valuable as just a research assistant in, let's say, a developmental lab?
It's an impossible question to answer. For some faculty members, that you have research experience of any sort is going to be just fine. For other faculty members, research experience in a very specific sphere is going to be important.
Okay. So it just depends. Yeah.
Yeah. And just to add, so there are like kind of two categories of research experience. One where like you're really just doing data entry, but you're in a lab and you're inputting data, and that is valuable and it checks a point on your CV. But when you come to the interview and you talk about your experiences and how it kind of opened your mind up to certain questions or furthered your interests or actually led you on a different path, it's hard to do that when you get really very limited experience. I know in the lab, Dr. Farber and I run, we're very focused on giving our RAs a lot of opportunity to actually get involved with all stages of the research project, because it's important, we think, and it's also helpful for us. And so I think if people have options, getting some research experience versus none, take some. But if you have options between what kind of research experience, something where it helps you understand your own interests or actually helps as an indicator to programs that you're truly interested in a certain research project or program, or even being able to speak to some different stages. I worked on an IRB proposal. I worked on setting up a Qualtrics survey. I worked on analyzing. I worked on a poster. I worked something more than basic data entry could be a nice carry on top.
Within those things you just mentioned, Daisy, are there any sort of skills that you think, if you're somebody who's currently in a research team, and you know down the line you want to apply to graduate school, are there any skills or experiences with software or specific experiences that you should focus on as you're making your way through this lab?
Yes and no. Oh, what did Dr. Farber say?
Qualtrics.
Qualtrics.
So here's the thing. No one should be scared of a PhD program because of software analysis. Everyone comes in feeling ill-equipped. They're very learnable. They are terrifying when you just look at the output and you're like, what is this? I'm not a scientist. I don't know how to do this. Like, don't worry. Don't let that keep you out. I would say like, if you're really like not good at interacting with people and most people leave the room crying after you talk to them, like don't do this career. But if you can't like read an FPS output, you're fine. You'll probably, most programs, I can't say all, of course, you'll learn these things. Of course, it depends on the advisor and the program. But I don't think undergrads, or I mean, it's a nice bullet point to add to your CV and maybe advise like statistics, like Dr. Farber mentioned, you're a lot better taking a post undergrad stats course, like a graduate level stats course, or even one advanced like regression or linear. I think programs are more excited about that than like which software you're using to analyze your data. Like, can you understand research? Could you translate that? Fine. Do you have to learn which program to use? It's like, it doesn't, I wouldn't say that's like a important thing.
And then what about published work? Are you only competitive if you've published?
I think it's a myth, meaning I think people think that, if I don't have a publication, I'm not going to get in. I don't think it's true. I think it's bonus points. It's not necessary nor sufficient. It's helpful. It's helpful.
Okay.
And I think research experience is important. You can be an RA. Is it great to have your name on at least a presentation at a conference? Absolutely. But it's helpful, but not necessary.
Okay.
And just to demystify kind of this process, and maybe this is unusual, but when I found out, I like thought I had all my boxes checked before I applied. And when I found out I should publish, someone told me I should have published and I didn't know. And it was a few months to applications being due. And I had worked with a nonprofit before and they had some data. And I basically developed this survey on Qualtrics, which is basically an online version of Word. So it shouldn't scare people. It's pretty easy and very user-friendly. I took a bunch of parts of different surveys, submitted it, you analyzed the data in a very simple way, like nothing complicated, submitted it to a conference. I thought it would get in. It got in. I presented the poster and then I had a poster on my CV. And so my point just is like, am I the most proud of that poster of everything else? Like, no. Is it the most rigorous and impressive? No. But did it do the trick? Yeah. And like, I needed two or three people to work with me. I didn't need to be in a lab. I didn't need to have a major famous name on it. I didn't need to have complex data. It was frequencies. It wasn't something complicated. So just if someone does want to, there's also ways to do it that are not, a lot of hoops to jump through.
Mm, So I think an area that I get a lot of questions in as well is once you've finished undergrad, when would you recommend that somebody get a master's before applying to grad, like to doctoral program? When is a master's helpful?
Well, a master's is helpful to the extent that if you don't have a lot of these other parts for your application, being enrolled in a 2 years master's degree program or even a 1 year master's degree program, you know, provides the easy on the ground opportunities to do all these things, to get involved in research, to introduce yourself to potential mentors, to take courses in stats, to take in almost any university, you know, a grant writing workshop. So, a master's degree offers you the opportunity to try things out and sort of enhance your application. I think about 70% or so of our admitted doctoral students have master's degrees.
That's at Teachers College. But that's not always the case.
I don't know what the, right. I'm not sure what the stats are nationwide.
Daisy, you did do a master's before your PhD. Why did you do it?
Because I didn't have research experience as an undergrad, and I didn't get to know psychology professors. And so I didn't have letters of recommendation. And I think this is like speaks to really every single response we've given to all of these questions so far, but also because all of this has had to be a competitive applicant, but it's also for people to actually figure out what they want to do and how to actually do something that they're interested in and be happy doing. And so for me, I was not sure at all what kind of research I was interested in, what kind of clinician I wanted to be, who I wanted to work with. And so the master's was a great opportunity for me to actually get a side-by-side view of all these different modalities and courses and research opportunities. And part of this is remembering not just getting your foot in the door. It's like, if you hate research in undergrad and hate research post-undergrad, you will hate your doctoral program most likely. And the same for clinical experience. So there are a few things that are not related. Like if you hate the GRE, you could still love graduate school. If you hate writing and you go to a research-oriented program where you need to publish, that's going to decrease your quality of life for a lot of years. And so going through all these experiences, keeping in mind that look at what you're doing and see how you experience it. And if you're not liking it and it's core part of a doctoral program, you might want to rethink doing the doctoral program. So for me, the master's program was like kind of a buffet to try different things and see what I liked.
Yeah. Thank you. Again, it's not, you guys aren't encouraging or not encouraging people to get master's degrees. I don't want people to think that, you know, just because Daisy did it, you have to do a master's. And that's not what anybody's saying here. You have to assess. And I'd say like, this is a podcast interview talking about very generally, you know, what are the things that are emphasized? What are the things that are important? But that doesn't mean that they're important to you or the specific programs that you are going to apply to. So rely on the people that you trust in your networks, your professors that know you well. Rely on people that know you and what you want out of your career to ask some of the more personal questions that may not be answered by this interview. So I just want to say that. The fact that I didn't say that at the beginning was probably bad, but but I just want to say that.
My one more point on that is that it's not the master's per se that makes you competitive to doctoral programs. It's the experiences you get while you're a master's student that might be worth the tuition of a master's degree. And so the saddest thing I think ever is someone doing a master's and rushing through it, taking all the coursework, getting to know no professors, not getting involved in any research, not taking advantage of master level clinical work, and just thinking, now I have a master's, let me apply. It's really flushing money down the
toilet. Waste of time. Waste of time, waste of money. Yeah. Yep. We didn't talk about clinical experiences yet, but I know that's another major thing. So I get this question, Daisy. I'm gonna direct this one towards you. How the heck do you find clinical experiences without a license?
Google has been my very dear friend in this area. Really, I think Google and there's a listserv if you're a master's student at Teachers College where people post clinical opportunities, but those also come from Google. Somebody else just does the Googling for you and sends it around. there are a lot of opportunities, I think, or in my experience, maybe it's getting to be less with time, but I really didn't find it to be so difficult. I think Googling clinical opportunities with a bachelor's, clinical opportunities with a master's, around whatever area you're in, living in, based on the things that you're interested in. I was interested in forensic psychology. I Googled forensic psychology firms in New York. I cold called an office. I asked if I could meet with the guy who ran the office just to ask him about the field. It ended up turning into a job. Another one came from a listserv that I thought my friend would be a good fit for. And I sent her to it. And then she needed a co-facilitator for a group, a support group. And then I joined her and it was like, really found that people are actually very interested. I have a bunch of RAs every time they want clinical experience. They find it. Sometimes it takes a month, sometimes it takes 2 months, but if all of them have clinical opportunities, I think networking, Googling, maybe the only specific tip I could say is that don't only look for like advertisements, people looking for clinical researchers or clinicians. You can also just look up places that do what you're interested in doing and email and ask if they would be interested in taking a volunteer. And people are usually very receptive to that.
Yep. There are hotlines
in most cities that are looking for volunteers all the time, working with the homeless, working with people who've just been incarcerated and out, or working, you know, in shelters. Working the hotlines for, there are hotlines in New York for people who are feeling suicidal. Most of those hotlines will take people with BA degrees and in a few sessions, sort of at least teach them the rudiments of how to talk to others who are distressed.
Yep. I will add that PsychMike has a newsletter that you may be signed up for. If you're not, go to psychmike.com and sign up. Shameless plug. But also we have we're revamping the website a little bit and turning and creating a blog, and that under that blog, you'll be able to see a post about how to get clinical experiences without a license. So we've sort of written about this. And so if you want more information, I'll direct you to psychmike.com. By the time this episode is up, that new website will be up and the blog will be up. So look for that, that blog title if you're interested. And then one more question about clinical experiences. Is it advised to do clinical experiences with populations and in settings that you think you might want to work with and that you're going to work with in graduate school? Or does it not matter as much?
I don't think it matters as much. I think faculty are mostly assuming that your opportunities are there, but limited. You can't always find a job as an undergrad or even between your BA and doctor working, say, with patients diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. But the general assumption is that you should have, as you've said, clinical experience working with a distressed population. And that's at least sufficient minimally to say that you've had this experience, that it didn't totally overwhelm you, and that based on this experience, you want to continue learning about it.
So, Dr. Farber, when you're looking at applications, is there anything that makes you go, wow, like this person really stands out?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm tempted to be snarky, but I'll try not to be. It's often my default position.
That's okay. You can be snarky.
Don't deprive the audience.
We want your snark.
I'll be serious first, then I'll throw the snark in perhaps later. I look for people who write extremely well. You know, that's my bias. I like people who write well. I look for people who can balance. I don't want the statement to be a prose form of a CV. I think what people need to do is find the right balance between helping me understand who they are, but without being TMI. You want to mention your therapy and that it's facilitated your wish to become a therapist, sure. But I don't really want to know every piece of your early history. So I think in general, you know, so what am I looking for? I want people who seemingly are who know what they're talking about, who aren't focused on generalities or cliches. To say I want to be a therapist because it feels meaningful to me is a cliche at this point. If, you know,
What is a good reason? Can you name something that somebody said recently that you were like, that's unique and that makes sense to me?
Perhaps either your own experience of being helped or a family member who was terribly distressed being helped, or maybe even something, it doesn't even have to be totally personal like that. I've been, you know, reading books about therapy. I've been reading Yalom. I've been reading case histories. And there's something about the way someone writes about this that made me read even more. So I want some in-depth understanding of both clinical stuff. And, you know, in your statement too, you're going to be focused on some piece of research. It's got to be in depth. It can't be, I'm interested in psychotherapy research. That's so broad. What about psychotherapy research are you interested in? What else? I want to know something about you, actually, even other than you're interested in psychology. You know, who are you when you're not thinking about a psychology career? You know, I don't mind. In fact, I kind of like telling me what books you've read, or, you know, what your hobbies are, or, you know, that when you listen to this music, it gives you a sense of, you know, being close to people. And that's even a part of why you're interested in doing the work. What else should I add?
This is helpful. This is helpful.
Daisy's answered this question too, I know, when people in our lab apply. What have you given as an answer?
And I think you really hit the nail on the head with the balance between giving a sense of who you are, while of course, through the narrative of how psychology plays into that, how your desire to become a psychologist plays into that, while also not doing the TMI. And so I think because our field does study mental illness and also values and prizes compassion and empathy, that some people kind of make the mistake of thinking that this is then, and a lot of people have had a lot of hard things happen to them, and that this is the good place to like share a lot of those details. But you also want to really balance the personal and the professional, maybe more than in any other field here. So I think, and I think the best advice I have for anyone with personal statements is do not leave it to the last minute, and do not submit it without showing it to at least two people that you trust that could give you accurate feedback, with you having enough time to integrate that feedback. It's not a small piece. It doesn't not matter. It does matter. Personal statement matters.
We'll come back to personal statements. I have a couple questions about that, but Daisy, I'm going to ask you sort of as a previous applicant, looking back, what parts of your application did you feel like were big pluses that you felt like when faculty would read it, they'd be like, I want her?
That's a good question too. I think my approach to applying to grad school was to really line up all my ducks before applying. So a lot of people have different approaches that work. They apply to a lot of programs and hope for two possibilities, which is amazing. Or they have some strengths and some significant weaknesses, but again, like overall hope their strengths. And I think I took 3 years between my master's and applying to PhD programs to really check every box kind of on the buckets that I dispelled out earlier. So I think one thing is I didn't have a very strong weakness. Of course, I wasn't a great fit for every program. There's a lot about fit, but I didn't have like a major, like, I hope people don't mind that my GRE is really low, or I hope people don't mind my letters of rec are old or not strong or unrelated to this field. Like, I think that's one strength, that overall I didn't have a significant weakness. I think the other thing is that it was really true for me that I really wanted to do this. And I think that my experiences spoke to that. And so again, I like really designated 3 years of my life to, or more, because I did the master's. So maybe 5 years of my life to being a competitive candidate. And that meant that like every program I applied to was very well researched. I saw a reason why we would be a good fit. no program like our program here, which is true. I met Dr. Farber in the master's program, and it was a long, long, long time dream that I had to come back and work with him. But I think the not having a major weakness, and I think that it was evident that I really did want to do this, and that I focused the past few years on well positioning myself to do this.
Mm. You're touching on something here.
Hey, let me add one thing as I'm remembering now. One of the feedbacks I did get was that my letters of recommendation stood out. And I think that it surprised me that was something to me. I was like, you know, if you're asking this person for a letter of recommendation, obviously they're going to give you a decent one or a good one. And like, I didn't realize that actually makes a very big difference. And so one of the things I advise people all the time is ask people with enough time for them to say, to work on a good letter, and also ask them if they feel like they could write a strong letter of recommendation. And that if not, that's fine. Because I realized how much that might matter, that people really read them and remember them. And
yeah. Yeah. I feel like I had a question for Barry, but now I'm forgetting. It'll come back to me. But Daisy, you were just talking about how you met Dr. Farber at your master's program. A question that I got is what are some steps that you can take in undergrad, or I'll say generally just before you apply to grad school, to help you find an advisor who would be a good fit in graduate school? Is there anything that you can do?
Google.
Yeah, Google.
Look at programs that are in the vicinity that you want to go, like that you want to live in, or that have affordable tuition rates, that the program might or might not be well known for having faculty that study certain areas of interest, and read a bazillion faculty profiles. Or if you're very limited geographically or tuition wise, you won't have that many programs. But I have an RA who just went through this, and it's just a lot. It was like, where could I live, and what are the programs there, and what are the ones that have good match rates there, and what are the ones I could afford? And let me go through profile after profile and see if I'd be a good fit. And that's a normal, it's a weird thing I don't know. Is there anything else, Dr. Weber?
I mean, at best, you're working for someone whose interests match yours and whose style matches yours. But it may be that those are the people, you know, a lot of people want to work with and don't have room in their labs or whatever. I would suggest, you know, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with.
Oh my goodness. Okay. I have a lot of questions about that. I have a lot of questions.
Including about this, like Steven being. Stills didn't like that song after it was written, but all right.
Sorry, I cut you off. Did you have anything else to add there?
No, you should be working. It's far better to work with someone whose style is different than yours, even whose interests may not match yours, than it is not to have experience at all. I mean, that's sort of obvious.
Hmm. Oh, wait, one other thing also, just remember to go to conferences where you might meet professors
who are presenting.
Yeah, that also helped. And then this is more rare, but if you have a mentor or an advisor or professor that you are close with and they know people that you're applying to, let them know. And in some cases, if they do really think highly of you, they might reach out to the program and just say like, hey, look out for that person's application. I think they're excellent. And
yeah, I will say I'll refer you guys to an episode where I think we talked about that a little bit more. It's with Dr. Aisha Metzger, and I think the episode title is Healing Communities from Racial Trauma. And in the episode, we talk about how to kind of grow your network of faculty, how to go about, you know, going to conferences and relying on your network of professors to find potential faculty that'll be good fits for you in graduate school. And she actually gives you like a template of how to reach out to people, which we'll talk about that in a second too. Okay. So now let's get into applying, because we've started sort of talking about this. First thing is you got to compile your list of schools. Daisy, I feel like you have a little bit of a formula here of the things you want to consider, you know, the major factors to consider when you're putting a list of school together. What are those factors? Okay, I hate to do this, but I'm going to leave you in suspense here, and I'm going to release the rest of the episode next week, all about actually applying to graduate school in clinical psychology. If you were left with more questions at the end of this, there are other resources you can check out in the show notes. But also, I'm going to encourage you to reach out to me at psychmikepodcast@gmail.com or on Instagram at the handle psych_mike. You can DM me. Let me know if you are left with any questions that you want to see answered in the future, either in another podcast episode or in a blog post or in a newsletter. Speaking of which, you should absolutely go to psychmike.com and sign up for the newsletter so that you can get career tips straight to your inbox. We also have a new blog on psychmike.com where you can access lots of more information on careers in and around psychology that will help get you from point A to point B. Lastly, if you could, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts if you're enjoying this show. It really helps grow the reach of this and helps people know what they should look forward to in this podcast. I would really, really appreciate if you took a moment to do that. Thank you so much for supporting Psych Mike with your enthusiasm and your questions, and I cannot wait to catch you next week for the second part of this interview.